great.
You need me to sign anything for Ali? Probably good.
Just a minute.
Gotta vote him first.
Arnie, I will act as chair. I will now call the meeting to order. I see we have sufficient attendance in the form of the board, so we can proceed. Is there anyone from the public, the general public here, for public comments? Absent that, we'll move into presentations, Siegel, Bryant, and Hamel. Thank you, Rose. What if there are any traffic issues coming up from where the...
When I got up here about half an hour ago, it was pretty smooth.
Yeah, it's more going down towards the airport.
Someone have it right here?
Right here?
Yeah.
Morning.
Good morning.
Presentations here.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here. It's always nice to be here from Chicago.
Yeah.
Thanks. Shy town, huh?
And you can leave one for the attorney.
Okay.
He'll probably come in later.
Good morning. My name is Jeff Paulus. I'm a partner and a co-portfolio manager on Small Cap Core Fund. I've been with Siegel Bryant for 14 years, and I'm the longest tenured member of the Small Cap team. I started with the Small Cap team there about a year and a half after inception of the product in 2000. I started in 2003. The product was born in 2002. Really appreciate the opportunity to be here today to review Siegel Bryant and Hamel with you, as well as giving an update on the Small Cap Core strategy. We turn to slide two, just a brief update on the firm. At the end of the first quarter, on March 31st, we ended with $10.7 billion in assets under management. That's up from $10.1 billion at the end of 2016. So very nice growth through the first quarter via market appreciation as well as new client wins. And actually last week, our CEO, Bill Hildebrandt, sent out a memo to the firm that we crossed $11 billion for the first time in the company's history as of the end of April. So very exciting, very good growth at the firm. We've been able to use that growth. From the asset perspective, we're very balanced as well. 40 to 45% is fixed income. The rest is equity. And really what that balance allows us to do is to continue to invest in people, technology, whatever else needs invested in over market cycles. So we're not worried if the equity market does well or does poorly, or the fixed income market does well or does poorly. And similar to your portfolio, asset allocation is very important. Our firm provides very, very nice balance, which allows us to reinvest into people and technology. One of the investments that we made a little over 2 years ago was an international small cap and emerging markets team based in Philadelphia. We actually carved them out of Philadelphia Investment Advisors. They came over with about $100 million in assets a little over 2 years ago, and that's now $750 million. So, you know, just an example of some of the investments we can make as a firm to continue to grow as well as diversify at the same time. International is not a product that we have. We do now, and it's doing very, very well for the firm. From a turnover perspective on the investment professional side, continues to remain very, very low. Haven't really lost anyone. We did lose a partner last year to an unfortunate and unexpected death in October of 2016. He's since been replaced. He was a director of wealth management, so more on the private client side versus the institutional side, so it didn't affect, your team at all. Turning to slide three, just a quick review before I get into the performance of the small cap strategy, our investment philosophy, really based on a couple of different factors, one being return on invested capital. We look for high return on invested capital companies, or companies that have opportunities to improve their return on invested capital. That tends to correlate very high returns on capital, and improving returns on capital tend to correlate very, very well to a strong investment performance over time. Obviously, there's points in the cycle where it works better, points in the cycle where it doesn't work as well, but over the long term, ROIC tends to be a very, very positive indicator for relative outperformance versus the market. We like to combine our ROIC focus with companies that focus on niche markets with a defendable competitive advantage. So basically, we're looking for companies that have no or minimal competition in their markets, and they have some type of competitive advantage, people, patent, process, that keeps bigger companies out. Either very, very small companies, larger companies like Google's and Amazon's can come in and compete competitive advantages away very, very quickly. So we focus a lot of our time on understanding these companies, what makes them special, and why it's going to keep other folks out. So we think combining with focus on return on invested capital, or how efficiently these companies are investing shareholder dollars to drive returns, with that niche market focus over time drives very, very strong performance. Not only that, one of the hallmarks of our product too is strong downside protection. So in very, very strong markets, sometimes you'll see us lag a bit, but when the market gets volatile, takes a downturn, our performance tends to be very, very strong. On slide four, you can see the account reconciliation performance at the beginning at the top. The account started with about $15 million on June 1st of 2011. There's been about $13 million in cash outflows since then for an adjusted net investment of $2.3 million. That value today is $9.3 million for a net change of $7 million. In the middle box, you can see the performance over the short term and the long term of the life of your investment in this product. Clearly not the results that you or I would have expected over this time frame, lagging on the 1, 3, 5 and since inception. More recently, things have improved in the first quarter, as well as so far second quarter today, which we can talk about in a minute. And I'll get into why we feel we've lagged the market over those time periods just a moment. If we look at the bottom box, you can see by year the performance. So beginning in 2011, when your investment came in, we had a solid year. Obviously, the market took a turn in the second half of the year to the downside, again, showing that downside protection that we're somewhat known for in the marketplace. 2012, the market rebounded. We weren't able to keep up. Some of the companies that contributed to strong performance in 2011 performed poorly in 2012, as well as there was a run. Banks did very, very well in the second half of 2012. We're always underweight banks, actually have been since the inception of the product. So that hurt us in 2012, and you'll hear about that in 2016 again, particularly in the fourth quarter of 2016. 2013, the market did extremely well, and we actually outperformed it. And again, we would consider that a very, very strong year for us. We typically don't do that well in strong on markets. Market at 40%, so we were extremely pleased with 2013. 2014 lagged again. A little bit on a gross basis, and what we dealt with in 2014 was a very, very strong year in REITs, utilities, and biotech stocks. We had no exposure to any of those sectors. Again, REITs and utilities don't fit that niche market company motto that we go for. And we saw a lot of interest rate, counter-interest rate sensitive plays in 2014, like REITs and utilities do extremely well. REITs, utilities, and biotechs were a 275 basis point headwind alone just in 2014, so our stock selection was good that year. The sector allocation was a big headwind. 2015, nothing really stuck out. I think we probably had a couple of company-specific issues that caused some underperformance there. And then we actually rebounded for the first three quarters of 2016. We were actually back in the top quartile, or just outside the top quartile from a performance perspective for the first three quarters of the year. And then post-election, you had a big run in banks and cyclical companies, and healthcare underperformed quite substantially. Well, as I mentioned earlier, we're always underweight banks, which performed well in the fourth quarter and always overweight healthcare because it fits that high ROIC niche market company philosophy that we have. So the combination of our underweight in banks, our overweight in healthcare, and the cash that we were carrying in the fourth quarter of around 7% all contributed to 500 basis points of relative underperformance for the fourth quarter alone in 2016. So not really.
Can you talk about that cash position? So is that
during
you start such a
it is, yeah. We typically target around 5% or less, and we've been running a little bit higher of late, actually, in so far this year, because we've had a lot of takeouts. And I'll get to that when I talk about the 2017 update.
Okay.
2017 has been a very, very nice year so far for us. But yeah, we typically start targeting about 5%. So that minus 500 during the fourth quarter really changed the complexion of that entire middle box. Cost us about 1% on the 5-year since inception, which obviously moved us on a growth basis to an underperformer over that time period. I'm happy to report that first quarter was extremely strong. The second quarter has also started out very, very strong. One of the reasons first quarter was strong is you saw a reversal in what was so strong during the fourth quarter. So banks started to underperform, healthcare started to come back. And not only that, we had two takeouts during the first quarter, which we haven't had a lot of takeouts over the past couple of years. And one of the hallmarks again of this product is actually the number of takeouts we get per year. Companies bought out by other companies typically average about 4 to 6 names per year bought out. The last couple of years, we've had 1 to 2, and they've been in the smaller weightings in our portfolio. This year, that's coming back, as I mentioned, 2 so far in the first quarter, and then actually we've had 4 so far in the second quarter. So we are up about 100 basis points on a relative basis so far Q2 to date, and 225 basis points on a year-to-date basis. So we're having a very, very nice year and a nice rebound from a difficult 2016. If I just key on that middle box again, just a couple of things briefly. What's caused kind of that underperformance over this medium term? There'd be a few things that I would point to. One, I talked about the lack of M&A in our portfolio. That's definitely been a contributor. Fortunately, that, like I said, is reversing itself quite nicely so far in 2017. One of the other things is just there's been a lack of volatility in periods of dislocation in the market. We do very, very well when the market gets volatile. When you see other investors panic, it really gives us an opportunity to go in and buy up companies, at relatively cheap prices, and take risk where other people aren't willing to do that. Our portfolio does have a contrarian approach. We're looking for cheaper companies, and that market volatility really allows us to step into some of those investment opportunities. Not only that, when the market is volatile, investors tend to focus on more of the attributes that we focus on, like return on capital, quality of companies, good free cash flow, which helps the downside, good balance sheets, which helps protect the downside, as well as competitive advantages. When the market gets volatile, people tend to panic, throw out names, and we're there to scoop them up, and we just haven't seen that. I actually have a chart on that in a couple slides. The other's been a slow interest rate environment. It's really wreaked havoc to a lot of active management, to be perfectly honest. The REITs, utilities doing well, biotech, just a lot of areas that we don't invest in, and we think others don't invest in a ton either. Also, you've seen this period of low interest rates as unprofitable companies, very low quality companies, do extremely, extremely well, and it's just not an area that we're going to play in. So we've had several headwinds over the last few years. From the lack of M&A, the lack of volatility, the low interest rate environment, and then just some stocks that didn't go our way. I mean, I'm not going to blame it all on the external environment. Clearly, if we would have had a few more stocks do better and a couple less stocks do worse, we're talking about something completely different. But as we got into 2017, as I mentioned, a lot of that is changing, and we're off to a really, really solid start. If you turn to slide 5, that's just the attribution for the first quarter, as well as some commentary on slides 6 and 7. Slide 8, this is the top two quintiles of the Russell 2000 index versus the bottom quintiles of the Russell 2000 index over market cycles. You can see when that line is heading up, you have the higher quality, higher ROIC companies doing better. When the line slopes down, you have the lower quality companies do better. You can see in periods where higher return on investment companies do better, which tends to correlate somewhat with more volatility, more uncertainty in the market. This strategy performs exceptionally well. 2007, we beat the market by, when the line was heading up, and higher ROIC companies were doing better, we beat the market by 11.4%. We followed that up in 2018 with 9.4% outperformance, so 20% cumulative outperformance over 2 years. We were able to keep up as the line sloped back down. In 2011, more volatility came into the market. Again, we outperformed by about 500 basis points, so very, very strong performance. You can see since that point, there was a long period of through 2012, 13, and 14, and even parts of 15, where lower quality names did well. Again, not an area that we play in, so we wouldn't expect to do extremely well in those types of environments. And then we started to see that line slope up again at the end of 15, and then 16, we saw that performance come back. So again, when higher quality, higher return companies do better, this portfolio tends to do extremely well. And obviously 2007, 2008, correlated with the financial crisis, higher volatility, more uncertainty. 2011, Europe was having some issues. Again, that showed up. On slide 9, I talked a little bit about how this strategy does very well when there's more volatility in the market. You can see from 2007 through 2011, you had in line to above average volatility in the market. That was the best five-year period this fund has ever had. Extremely, extremely strong performance over that time period. Since then, volatility has been lower than average every single year. Obviously presented us with a bit of a headwind, as I mentioned. And this actually was cut off in the middle of March is the last updated figure that I saw. 2017 was off to a much lower volatility. Fortunately, some of that M&A in our portfolio is coming back, really driving a nice year. So in addition to having a nice, we've had some nice stock moves as well, just individual stock moves. We did see volatility pick up at the end of March and into early April, and then subsequently retreat. But when that volatility picked up at the end of March and into April, again, the portfolio did exactly what you would expect it to do. So
I think I read a Wall Street Journal article or something about the volatility in maybe like the first 3 months of the year, mm-hmm. that it was like the lowest it had been, yep. in, I don't know, 30 years, yep. or something like that. Yep. And so it's interesting, though, that you outperformed in the quarter, right. you know, given mm-hmm. that situation.
Yeah, we had a couple of takeouts which would contribute to that. Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, chicken and biscuit company, was actually a large name in our portfolio, was bought out. But again, the what you saw in fourth quarter, which was very difficult for us, you saw some of those factors reverse themselves as well. So despite low volatility, you had healthcare do very well during the first quarter. We're well overweight healthcare, and you saw banks underperform and underweight banks. So it's just a reversal too of the dynamic of the fourth quarter. So you know, points in time, fourth quarter looked very, very tough. Some of that starts to reverse one quarter, for, you know, one Q looks a little bit, you know, looks better. So, and then obviously in the 2Q as well, we can take to see some very nice progress to dig ourselves out of that hole.
So, I mean, when you look at your performance, so if you look on page 11 or you look back on the other pages,
yep.
For your performance, and we've basically had you for the five-year period.
Yep.
And then you look at your inception number, which you had back here, and net of fees, you're about 200 basis points under the benchmark, which is, you know, we want you 200 basis points above the benchmark. And we've talked some to that, but, you know, these trustees sit here with a very difficult job. They've got pensions to pay, and so they build a portfolio, hoping everyone will at least meet the benchmark or outperform. And so, as you know, in the last couple of years, a lot of people are moving to indexing. It's a lot cheaper. It's hard to really justify paying active fees for getting a return below a benchmark. So talk a little bit around, you know, if you were in their shoes, why would you choose to stick with this portfolio? You know, obviously we can't change anything that's happened in the past, so we're sitting here today. Why do you think that your portfolio will outperform the index going forward and would be a better place to stay than maybe going to index?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. You know, you can look at the long-term performance of us over market cycles. I mean, 5 years isn't a complete market cycle, as I mentioned. You know, return on capital focus, you know, does well in some time periods, does not as well in others. So, you know, we think, you know, based on what we're seeing in the market as well as our portfolio, it's a, yeah, and particularly after the results that we've seen, it would be, we think, a very bad time to exit the strategy. But you have a couple of things going on that makes this, that's starting to make this time period, I think, a little bit more like we've seen in the past. One is interest rates are going back up. So you're seeing people, you're seeing REITs, utilities, things of that nature start to underperform again. And not only that, the macroeconomy has picked up as well. And so the combination of those two things gets people to focus more on these niche market, defendable competitive advantage companies in these sectors that we are typically overweight. So if you turn to slide 13, you can see the areas I'm talking about, industrials, tend to do very well when the macroeconomics pick up, as well as the rates are rising. Technology, materials, all of these sectors people haven't really been all that excited about because the macroeconomic environment has been a bit slow and rates have been high, so they've been focused more on bond-like stocks, so to speak. Companies that don't exhibit much volatility. Areas like utilities, REITs, as I mentioned several times now. When rates go up, those are become a lot less attractive. And when the macro improves, companies in cyclical sectors become much more attractive. So we think that, you know, over time, companies that have high returns, very quality, good management teams, good cash flow, great balance sheets, are all going to perform over time. It's happened over longer periods. We've had a difficult period. I mean, a lot of active management has had a difficult period. But when you see some of the market dynamics that are currently happening or the changes that we're seeing now, it's going to give a tailwind. We think it's going to give a tailwind to us and potentially to other active managers as well. We're off to a very strong start, as I mentioned, in 2017. And we feel really good about where the portfolio is at. Not only that, if you look at our portfolio versus an index, the Russell 2000 index, you're getting a lot of very lower quality companies in that index. Our portfolio has higher quality characteristics, as you can see on slide 14. Our return on investment, the third line down, 15.5% versus 7.8% from the index. We have higher projected growth. Our multiples are a little bit higher for the time being, but I go back to the old adage, you get what you pay for. You're looking for good companies that can withstand the test of time, that can survive over market cycles and flourish over market cycles. You know, that's really what we're after. And we've just been in a period where people haven't been focused on that, given the very, very low interest rate environment. And we're getting back to that. The Fed's raised rates a couple of times now. We think they continue to do that throughout the year. So we're just going to continue to do what we do because it's generated very, very, very strong performance over market cycles. So again, we tend to do very, very well in those downside markets. Just look at what we've done in some of the periods in the past where the markets, volatility's entered the market, uncertainty's entered the market. Just 1 year like that completely changes the complexion of the track record.
Any questions from the board?
Yeah, what, remind me of the fee?
It's 1%. And we would be willing to, we're seeing fee compression all over the market, so we'd be willing to knock that down to 90 basis points going forward.
We sometimes have a discussion in terms of going from actively managed to passive. What would be your response?
I would say if you're going to go passive, you want to do it in areas like large cap or mid cap in the portfolio. Small cap, again, with the nature of the index and how it's constructed over time, active management is for sure the way to go. No doubt in my mind. Again, it kind of takes market cycles. It's been a difficult period for active management, but I think if there's anywhere you do not want to go passive, it's in small cap. Because you can see these huge relative return years. Both to the positive and the negative. I mean, this nature is a small cap portfolio. But over time, active management in small cap is the way to go. I would hate to see anybody go passive. But we've seen it. We've definitely seen it. But we think over the long term, small cap is not the area that you want to go passive in.
Anything else? Well, we definitely appreciate your coming to us today,
yep,
and giving us your explanation to the history and your hopes for.
Yeah, no, it's definitely been difficult. It's been a difficult time. I mean, like I said, 2007 to 2011 was fantastic. 11 to into 16 was difficult. I think we're, hopefully this is a new five-year period that we've just begun, because it's begun quite strongly, and we're feeling very, 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 very good. So I appreciate the opportunity to come in and talk to you, and hope to see you again in the future, so thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. Doug, I believe you're up.
All right. I think you might have a hard copy of the report. If not, I've got them on iPads. Perfect. All right, let's, I think maybe the best way to go about it is to sort of work backwards. I think if I, the report, it says the experience study they did May 5th. I'll leave this thing around right now. All right, let's work backwards, and then I think if we go from a bigger perspective, you know, the bigger picture, and then get down into the details as we need to, it'll be a more productive discussion. And so I think sometimes working backwards is the best way to go about that. So that would actually be on page 16. And here's why I think that. You haven't really fallen that short on your assumptions, except for what you've been hearing me say for the last 3 to 5 years, early retirement. And I looked up the last study we did, the last experience study, and it's been, I think, about 6 years now. We brought it to everyone's attention at that time that the old assumption that when members get to early retirement eligibility, we were only assuming 2 out of 100 would take it. And I said at that time, I said, well, that's been happening a lot more often than closer to 10% at that time. Well, I'll give you some details here in a little bit after we move away from this back page, but it's been sometimes closer to 15 to 25%. Meaning when people get to that 25th to 30th year, or they get after age 55, they've been hitting the road. And so those have been the big sources of loss the last number of years, because the early retirement benefit is subsidized. It's not a true actuarial hit. It's only a 3% per year so-called penalty. So the true present value of what they're getting paid out, yes, it's a reduction from their normal retirement if they had stayed an extra 5 or 10 years, but it's not the full hit. Okay? And I think there's all number of reasons why people have been taking early retirement more often, but it's been the behavior. In fact, I was kind of surprised. I thought that people would have been taking early retirement more often after the big plan change in 2012, but they were leaving in droves before 2012.
Well, I mean, and I can speak to that. In 2008, the city did what was called the ERIP, the Early Retirement Incentive Program. So we, because of the recession at that time coming into place, the city said, let's see if we can reduce payroll without a layoff. Let's incentivize people to retire. So at that time, 79 employees took the early retirement incentive program. So to me, that's like we would not normally have had that many people leave. We actually brought people into retirement at that time. We brought them up to 3 years. If they were within 3 years, we brought them in. So it cost like $9 million. The market dropped, the day after the check was just a mess, but performance-wise. But so that was a huge, you know, our assumption, yes, would have been off, because that was not something we would have planned to do. And then in 2011 or 12, we did the VSIP, the Voluntary Separation Incentive Program. Unlike the ERIP, the VSIP did not buy anyone in. So you had to be early retirement eligible. So if you're eligible via age or years of service, you could take it. What we used to incentivize them at that time was insurance. So we would give you insurance for 3 years or give you a cash payout. I think the max payout was like $20,000 at the time, so you could buy insurance if you hit 1 million hours or whatever. And we had 44 people take that early retirement program. So I think absent those two programs, if we pulled out those 2 years, I don't know that our experience would be as, you know, now they happen, like kind of like Rose said, we can't change what happened, this will happen. So the plan now looks how the plan looks. But I think those two events really made that percentage be as high as it is. If we would pull those events out, I think our normal early retirements are much, they're not quite 2%, they're a little behind with that, but for history's sake, for those who weren't here from the Dr. D's position.
No, that's
but I agree. It's effective time is effective time. I don't think at the time I would say, you know, if you step back financially and look at the plan globally, at the time the objective was we got to lower payroll because we don't have enough revenue coming in to keep all these employees. And they didn't want to do mass layoffs. So the hope was if we had enough employees voluntarily leave, and typically the ones closer to retirement are on the higher end of the pay spectrum, pay ranges, that we wouldn't have them, and it worked both times. We didn't have to do any layoffs. We're one of the few cities that didn't have any layoffs during that time. Now, on the other side of that, which, you know, of course, the finance here is screaming, oh, there's a cost on the other side. You know, like, you can't pick up the head without the tail there, but they were looking for more immediate cost savings, if you will, to lower payroll, to keep people employed, and, you know, some raises, and we had tons of different things that we did, but, the long-term effects, you know,
did
have a cost.
Yeah. So this is all good information to have this discussion. I figured, well, and I took into account exactly what Cindy just mentioned, that there were a couple of incentive type programs to get people out the door. And the plan's closed. And so more and more people are not going to be eligible for early retirement because it's a finite group of people. So I created a new assumption based on what's primarily happened since 2012, not the entirety of going back 10 or 15 years. But we can still discuss whether we think those are the right rates going forward or not. So let me do this. Let's back up and look at some tables here on early retirement and then figure out if we all agree that going forward this might be a good assumption. Let's go back to page 11, the number at the bottom. These tables at the bottom, as I just mentioned, are based primarily on everything since 2012, because I noticed that after the big incentives were done, this has been the experience in the last 5 years. And the left-hand column deals with people who have 25 or more years of service. Remember how you can retire with early retirement. Either age 55 with 5 years of service, or you have 25 years. And there's a difference in the benefits. If you retire with 25 years, then the reduction that you get is only 5 years. We determine the penalty based on what would have been your 30th year, because that's normal retirement. But if you retire at age 55 and you don't have 25 years in, you're taking a full 10-year hit. So I decided we're going to break out people who retire with at least 25 years versus those who don't, and see what kind of behavior might have happened. So left-hand column on page 11 shows that those retiring with 25 or more years of service, still significant, those assumption rates, at the 25th year there was, and the 27th year, there was a big outflow. What that 21% means that if everybody who is eligible when they hit 25 years, 21 out of 100 took them, 21%. At the 26th year is 11%,
The 27th year is 23%. So really, it looked like in the first 2 years after hitting the 25th, that's when most everybody left. Then when it came to the 28th and 29th years, it really started tapering off. And likewise, if you look at the right-hand column, people who had less than 25 years, so the only way they could retire is between 55 and 64, there wasn't a whole lot of movement from 55 to 61. We're talking about 11 to 13%, but then as soon as you hit 62, boom.
Social Security.
Social Security. 24%.
Magic number.
One out of four. And then it tapers off again.
Anthony, that one would apply to you.
72. Yeah, <okay. laughs> So the discussion here is this, and it's a guess. Since so many people have left, you know, how many people are still in the plan that will be eligible for early? It's a lot less than there were. Now, that doesn't mean that just because there's a lot less eligible for early that the rates won't still happen, okay? But even if the rates continue to happen this way, the impact over time becomes less. You know, we've taken the big hit. It caused increases to the unfunded. So the question is, well, first of all, we definitely need to increase about 2%. I just don't see an early retirement rate going back to 2%. But the question is, will they still be this high going forward? It was a lot higher until 2012. It somewhat tapered off. But, you know, will the city offer another incentive in the next 5 years? No one can say that now.
I would just say the odds are slim because the amount of participants left in the plan is so minimal. I mean, there's, what, 200?
Right about 200
people left in the plan. Some of those being the old DB, so they were my grandfather, so those are starting to drop off. They were within 5 years when we did the change in 2013. So those are, they're still here. They're now going to be normal retirement eligible, so that drops off 30-ish people, I think, of those 200. So I would just think, you know, with 1,100 employees to incentivize 150 people to go would not really be. The math wouldn't work, so it would probably make a difference to us. Especially if we have a negative impact on the plan, and then it's closed, we have no money coming, you know, so.
Well, that's a good point.
That would not smart for us to do.
It's a good segue here to have this discussion. If you go this route, and these would, it sounds like we would be considering this to be a conservative assumption going forward, meaning we would be forcing.
I mean, unless council wants to get out. I mean, to me, that would be the only reason. Like, if they said, if we had a...
Well, here's the interaction with the variable incentive program. We just re-ran the corridor test, and there was some improvement, meaning the city's contributions are back within the corridor, but it's nowhere near getting the members a lower contribution rate or a higher multiplier. So let's do two scenarios here. One is we punt and you stick with the 2% on early retirement because you don't want to cause the cost to go up. You don't want the unfunded to go up by changing it. But people do start taking early retirement more often than 2%. Then what happens is I'll come back the next couple of years and say you're continuing to get some early retirement loss. Not as bad as it was, but we're still not making the assumption. If you go this route, let's do the other extreme. You go this route, which is conservative. Initially, you go slightly back outside the corridor, which doesn't really have any impact right now whatsoever because everybody's maxed out. The members are putting in 5%, and they're only getting a 1% multiplier, so there's no harm on the variable incentive program.
The harm is city has to write a check for the
correct. But what happens is extra cash starts coming in the plan, getting invested, and the unfunded starts coming down more rapidly. So in the end, I want the most reasonable assumption we can have. So now that you know that the extremes of the impact of whether you go with 2% and stick with it, or whether you go to these rates, you know the extremes. So the question is, which is the most reasonable assumption going forward?
How about something in the middle?
Whether that's the most reasonable or not, I don't know. I probably, given what I've heard from Cindy today and what we all know has happened, the plan's closed, it's a smaller population, fewer and fewer people will be eligible for early retirement going forward. So the early retirement assumption has a diminished impact from this point forward every year.
Where did the 2% come from?
Long ago, when the plan was open and running on all cylinders, and that was a better assumption. That was pretty reasonable at the time.
You know, and if you think to, you know, generationally, if you will, like who we have working at the city now, there's also a shift in that regard. Like, of course, back when plans opened in the late 90s or whatever, you know, like it, people came to work at a job and you stayed at that job until you retired. You know, the recession changed that behavior. The new generations entering the workforce have changed that behavior. You know, like the Xers, the Yers, and Millennials, you know, you tend to see more of a 5-year, maybe to 8-year lifespan, if you will, with an employer. You know, the 401k became more attractive, you know, so I think, so the assumptions that were pitched back when the plan was put in place made sense for, you know, the job market and the economy and the time that was present, you know, back then. But a lot has changed since then. So I agree that 2% is not, it's obviously not realistic. So we're not anywhere close to that. Where, you know, what the right percentage is. Yeah.
Well, I have a question for the assumption.
Yeah.
Assumption, another word is a guess. I think, given that we've had, you know, an actuary is always looking for information, I think we've had some good information here today where I would not be uncomfortable splitting the difference. And maybe just taking these rates and cutting them in half. So, for instance, on the 25 years or more, instead of it being 21, say 10 and a half. Instead of it being 11 at the 26th year, make it 5 and a half. The 27th year, 11 and a half. And since it's a real guess, we don't need to get down into the nitty-gritty. I think we can all agree it has to be above 2, but probably agree that it maybe doesn't need to be this high. Now, I could come back in 5 years with the next experience, Denny, and we'd find out that we were wrong. But it's a diminished impact going forward. So I actually would be fine just taking all of these rates and cutting them in half. And I can give you the rough impact of that if you go back to the last page. Because it's really, and we'll get back to the investment return, or we'll get there shortly, but look under early retirement rates. Adopting what we just looked at on page 11, that's an increase to the city of $641,000 per year. See that columns contribution increase / decrease? That's the biggest, aside from the investment assumption, that has the biggest impact here. So ballparking, if we take the rates on page 11 and cut them in half, then it's really more like a $320,000 a year. The unfunded goes up about $1.5 million instead of $3.5 million. So before we finish up the discussion and early and move to others, do you want to have any more commentary on this assumption? Or dig in a little bit more.
You mentioned being in the corridor, of course, finally, you know, we've been in the corridor since late and stuff.
Yeah, barely in it.
You know, I'm excited about that. It was not enough to cause a change in the multiplier or the employee contribution, which going to other rating with contributions for sugar.
Yep.
Do you have any idea where we need to be percentage-wise to start to see the employee contribution?
Yeah, it's in the ordinance. At least for this year, it would have been 37%.
Oh, we're at 50%. Never mind.
Yeah. But I'll tell you what, the faster you hire people to the city because they're going into DC, the more you do that, the faster you get the corridor down.
Right, because my total payroll goes up, but on the chief side.
Mm-hmm, correct.
And so then when I average it out, it's going to.
So the city ends up doing a big wave of hiring in the next couple of years, combined with some salary increases. You're going to find yourself maybe coming down a little faster. And because remember, the corridor is set in the ordinance. It has a table.
Right.
And it shows for each year where the city's requirement needs to be in order to trigger either lower benefits or higher benefits. And then when I say benefits, I mean the member contributions and the variable multiplier. Right now, you're at the worst of everything, 5% member, 1%.
I think from the employee's perspective, that's at least what I'm hearing is, you know, when are we going to get that 5% back to free?
It'll be a little while.
It'll be a minute. We had assumed a few years, if the plan performed this way and it continued to perform this way, then we could get there.
Yeah. We might have been there. Well, no, we still wouldn't have been there. We were taking the early retirement hits during those early years. But had we had the assumption like you just saw on page 11, it would have initially pushed us even higher. And then, but then when you got back in the corridor, you would have been getting there faster. Pay now or pay later. So we can either. How do you want to handle this? Do you want to handle dealing with this assumption decision now, or do you want me to go on to some couple of the other highlights here and we'll swing back to it?
What would you recommend?
Let's swing back to it at the end because you're probably still digesting it and you probably still want to hear a couple of the other highlights from this study. And then we can kind of come back, summarize it, and then see if the board's ready to make a decision. And by the way, you don't have to make a decision today. You know, these are assumptions that will be put in the next valuation. So I don't want you to feel any pressure like you need to give the actuary an answer today. You don't. Okay, so let's deal with the other heavy hitter here, the investment return. I don't have any particular recommendation here, but I always like to show if you changed it, what it would be. And we're still on page 16, and see the number 896,000. If you told me to do nothing except lower the assumption from 7 to 6.75 today, then the city would have to write an extra $896,000 each year for the trust fund going forward, at least initially, because a 6.75 is a guess. Okay. Now, here's the sticky part. Right now, you can't make a change to the investment assumption. The ordinance forced two assumptions to stay, that took away control from the board. Investment return and mortality. Well, the state trumped the city with mortality, so that's no longer an issue. But so the one assumption that the board doesn't have any control over is the investment return. Right now, it says 7, period. So part of this discussion is, at some point, if the actuary and Rose and the board says we need to be lower than 6 points or lower than 7, then you're going to have to work with the city to change the ordinance to just strike, which I think is actually a good idea, period, to just get the city to agree they don't have any discretion on the investment or any of the assumptions. You should work collaboratively, but to have a mandate that you must use 7%. It is what it is. It's been there for 5 years now. But I think it would be a good idea to see that stricken so that control can be reverted back to the board with its professionals. So I'm showing you the number, I'm showing you the impact on the unfunded liability. You can see that it would go from 90.1 million to 96.7. And again, the funding impact would be 896,000 a year. But right now, you can't lower it, you can't change it. And by the way, when I saw Arnie hitting the elevator, getting ready to go to the hospital, he says, why don't we just go to 6.5? And I said, well, I'll tell the board, it would double everything you see here. So I'll turn it over to everyone else here for discussion on it. Investment assumption. If there is any discussion to be had.
Well, the city's not going to like you to recommend that because then they have to write.
Yeah, I'm not recommending it. I just, as part of a study, I will typically show my boards a 25 basis point reduction just so you can see what it would look like. Eventually, this plan will need to be, what do you think, Rose? Probably in the fives, 5.5, 6 max?
I believe, no, 5.5 eventually.
And 7 is high.
Well, 7's high because it's closed, maybe a little high. Doug took our assumption rates and, you know, got to 6.87. So, of course, the last 5 years have been a lot better than that. You know, so you've done a lot better than that net of fees over the last 5 years. But again, plan's closed. So, closed plan, you want to get to like 5.5 or so eventually.
And but you all understand why, right? The plan needs more cash to pay out benefits. You can't have long-term investments tied up.
And then we'll move more toward the bond.
Yeah, it'll be, yeah, that's what 5.5 would give you, maybe very, like, almost an indemnify type plan. But right now, you do have a target around 7. Your asset allocation supports that, about 7%. I'm not here to recommend you lowering it right now. I think it's okay. But probably when we sit here in another 5 years, we'll probably have to do that. Maybe a little bit sooner. But I think the average, what's the average? 7.5, 7.6 or something, plans that are open. So, and you being a closed plan, so it'll have to ratchet down.
And the fact that you're at 7, that's typically what the state reviewing actuaries have been looking for when a plan closes. You haven't been closed that long. Okay? So, 7 to me is still reasonable. And the investment assumption discussion is more and more complex and heated every day. There's different big actuarial firms out there really pushing for high fives for open plans right now. Most actuaries who work in the municipal side think that a plan like this is so big and you've only been closed 5 years that 7 is fine.
There's a lot of politics behind a lot of all of that, but yeah.
The state seems to be pushing the 401 or the DC type plan. You know, the legislation that was on the table was to mandate or default you into the FRS investment plan versus the FRS pension plan. You know, it's like kind of step one to move them away. And also, the legislation talked about closing FRS to new entrants. So if you're not already in FRS post July 1, you can't get in. Alternatives to that, you did get in, you have to get the investment plan. So, you know, there's a march to eliminate the DBs, if you will.
In the corporate world, actually going the opposite way.
They're starting to go back.
They're starting to go back because the corporate world got rid of them long before the public world did. And so the corporate world now, and if you look at the Wall Street Journal and things like that, they are coming out with more and more articles that what happened when you have only a 401k and you don't have a DB, you don't have regular retirements, right? So people don't actually retire. And so they've done some study that basically says one person at the top is blocking like 8 or 9 people coming in, right? So you have these older folks who are staying because they have a 401k that's based on the market, has, and they don't have a DB. And so instead of retiring, and you have this sort of, with a DB, you have this sort of normal retirement you can expect, and then you can hire younger people and stuff. You're sort of seeing this. And so companies are worried about their innovation. They're worried about all these things because they're not able to hire on this end because, and there's a lot of ageism and things like that, so it's not like they can force, you know, force people out and those kind of things. So they were realizing that maybe getting rid of the DB is going to have unintended effects for their bottom line going forward because they're not able to have those sort of normal course of retirements.
And on the other side of that, of course, is that it does provide stability in terms of income for people when they do retire. And the reason people are staying in the 401k plans is they want as much as they can have in the form of a nutshell, because they're not going to have a guaranteed income. So I brought this up, I think, a number of times at these meetings, you know, it's a mistake to leave the defined benefit world, and it looks like at least private industry is coming back to it, and conceivably.
Well, they're talking about it.
No, actually transpired.
Yeah. Because you'll look at some of the big DB plans with, you know, auto industry and those guys that they still can't afford, you know, to pay out those older plans. You know, they are having cuts to retirees in those plans, you know, via forced action.
I think the design of the plans, of the DB plans, will be different in the future, where conceivably there will be some risk sharing, because that was one of the reasons that private industry left them, because they just could not put up with these massive swings in the liability. If I might ask, Doug, with regard to the early retirement discussion and the percentages, what do we then come to, some type of blended rate as a percentage, or you're going to use, like you were indicating, why don't we just cut all of these in half?
I'm comfortable.
Do you then divide by 5, or I mean, or is your?
I'm since it's all a guess, what we have in that table, you know, from 25 to 30, and then 55 to 64, those are all the relative rates as you go from one age and service to the next. So I'm fine to straight line taking half. And so that gets us somewhere, I don't want to use just a straight, like we use 2 for everything. I don't want to just say use 5 for everything. I'd rather just take the rates as they are from the study and taking 50% of them. So let's review that real quickly. Back in page 11.
21 would go to 10.5.
Correct.
11 would go to 5.5.
Correct.
23 would go to 11.5.
That way we maintain the relative behavior rates, so that at the 26th year it's still about half of the 25th year, the 27th year is still about the same as the 25th, but we're just taking half of them. And then in 5 years, see what happened and make another adjustment if we need to. These are probably a little, this reflects reality for the last 5 years, but at this stage in time right now, it might be a little overly conservative. On the other hand, maintaining 2% is probably being a little too aggressive. So that's why I think just cutting all of these in half on this table will give me a comfort level. And so, roughly speaking, you can look on page 16, and instead of it being 640,000 a year, be about half of that impact.
Is the board of a mind to go forward with the recommendations of the actuary at this time? Which case, is this an item for vote?
Well, let me, before you get to that, are you talking about just the early retirement or everything else?
Really, the entirety just, of it.
Let me take a couple minutes just to go over the other ones, just so you're aware of what you're voting on. Sounds like we're okay with the 7%. So we don't, And by the way, you couldn't do anything with that anyway. Let me just very quickly go over the impact of the others and give you the cliff notes. Mortality rates, $46,000 a year increase. That's the latest adjustment from the FRS. They made adjustments to the active mortality, so this reflects that. We would have to put this in next year anyways. So if you want to see, it's like, what is 46,000? Well, the city's already putting in 15.2 million. So it's 46,000 above that. Withdrawal rates, turnover. We found out that people are leaving primarily in the first 5 years, but not a whole lot after that. And so making an adjustment to reality means the city would have to go up an extra 83,000 a year. We think that's reasonable. NOMA retirement rates, slight decrease. Members have been deferring normal retirement a year or two. They actually get to that point, they start thinking about it, then they retire. So there's a, by deferring retirement, it's small savings. And finally, salary scale. Salary increases have not been coming in according to the old assumptions. So if you modify it to what's happened in the last 5 years or so, the city's costs go down about $108,000 a year. So if you adopt, let's say you adopted everything except the investment return. As the study shows, it would be $637,000 a year increase to the city. But if you're getting ready to adopt everything, but only half of the early retirement, then the city's increase would actually be about probably $300 to $350 over what it is currently. And the unfunded liability would probably, it would go from $90 million to probably $92 million or so.
Not a real big impactor.
So we're talking about staying at combined 7 and adopting everything else but half of this.
Combined 7, but half of the early retirement, everything else the same. So that's the summary. So you can make your movement now if you like.
Ask the board if there are any more questions, comments, and if not, I would ask someone to make a motion with regard to the acceptance of the assumptions as presented.
Approve or make a motion to approve the assumptions.
Second. And I have a second. All in favor? Aye.
Okay, I'll take it into the next valuation and go over it then.
This would be for the October 1,
2018.
2017.
Yeah, so it'll affect cities
18-19.
Yep. Doug, do you have something that you could send me that, or is it in the valuation that you're going to do for October that shows maybe like cash flow, like that would show like how you sort of expect the plan to be paid. Is there
actually,
anything
yeah.
that shows that, like over time, just for investment purposes and liquidity? It'd
yes.
be nice to see.
There's a section in there. There's
okay.
In the current report.
There's a section of it.
Give me a call.
Okay.
When we're both back in the office, I'll send you the report and I'll show you the two pages that every year you can see an update on that.
Definitely.
Yeah, because overall for us, I don't have a grant money, but in the next like 5 years, we have a lot of stuff that drops off as far as unfunded liabilities. So that would help, you know.
And that's something that I think Rose and I would both agree, probably in the next 5 years, the plan matures even more and we really get to the point where we need to start thinking about lowering the assumption of running a asset liability run out for 10 or 20 years to find out at what point does the plan become cash flow negative and to what magnitude. So it'll help the investors decide, okay, well, where do we need to shift allocations?
And it would help me, you know, just because we plan our operating budgets like 3 to 5 years out, so for me to know, you know, like these assumptions, so I can just use this report, like knowing going into 19, I'm going to need to have a little more money available from a contribution standpoint. You know, I'm not understanding the markets, but I just know I'm going to need more money. mailbox, so if I had that for a few years to see, like, you know, where could I potentially be? I'd want council to know that, is there setting back millage rates and setting reserves, do they want to put someone aside, because we know, you know, this point is dwindling the participation, so.
Yep.
Yeah, that would be helpful.
We'll now move forward to the attorney's report, Lee.
Okay, well.
Sort of skipping it, Bernie.
I'm sorry.
You skipped my report.
Consultant's report, presentation.
What did I, oh, I jumped over you, did I? Okay. Well, I didn't mean that, that was totally unintentional.
But we can go first.
Lee, is it all right if I withdraw the offer?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Hammond.
For sure.
So you all should have your books in front of you, the little green books here.
Say it's my first time.
You're trying to get fired, aren't you?
And so we'll just go to tab one, page one, and you'll see our market conditions are still sort of the same. They changed the format, they're always trying to make things look a little prettier, I think, and they also don't want me to get used to the same thing, so I have to keep up on my game here. But you can see we had a very strong quarter. And the international markets actually outperformed the U.S. markets, which, you know, last 5 years we had been talking through the end of December that, you know, the international markets were just really, really compressed. And coming out of the Trump election, we had a big jump for the U.S. equity markets, but because of trade and everybody being concerned abroad about what would happen in China, you know, the fourth quarter wasn't good for international either. But coming into the first quarter, I think a lot of that's died down. You see international up 7% versus our domestic return of 5.7. So very strong there. The dollar had strengthened in the fourth quarter, and then that had reversed a little bit in the first quarter, which was helpful. You could see fixed rates, as we had talked about, you know, coming down. Very difficult on the fixed market, given the fact that interest rates, the Fed has been increasing interest rates. Commodities was negative for the quarter, so any equities that you had that were linked to commodities were affected by that. So, you know, a company that would work with oil or things like that would be affected by those kind of things. Real estate, this is a little bit of a lagged return there, but for 7.3 for the year. Private equity, strong returns, and then hedge funds. Had a good quarter finally to see hedge funds there, and then a 6% on the trailing 1 year. If you flip to the next page, you can actually just see the numbers there, and you can see world equity, which is U.S. and non-U.S., up 14% for the trailing 1 year, 6% for the quarter. And then the Russell 3000 up 5.74 for the quarter. But if you look at the non-U.S. equity market, and that's developed international markets, so that's big companies like Nestle, you know, big, large companies that trade a lot here and sell things here. If you look at that 10-year return, still almost flat, 1%. I was at a client meeting a couple weeks ago, and I said, well, that means you need to put more money in here. And they didn't really like that idea, but... We split the difference, but you know, you can see that I mean, just really a reversion of the mean, that has to come up. You know, those companies can't be so really beaten up for so long when they are doing well and they're making profits and they, you know, so emerging markets did very well for the quarter, up 11%. That's an asset class that you got into was a tough start for you, but you're seeing really the rewards of that, a 17% return for the 1 year. And you can sort of see fixed here has been, you know, obviously negative on non-U.S. fixed. Real estate has done well. If you look over the 10-year period, private real estate has basically done better than most asset classes, underperforming slightly the U.S. equity market, but I mean doing very, very well. And you've had really good real estate managers, and that's helped you. Having 12% in real estate has done very well for you. And then hedge funds, just been really a tough time for hedge funds over the last 5 years and 10-year periods. and we're seeing a little bit of that come back in the quarter. I'll just flip. I'm not going to go through all of these. I never do, but just like to look at the fixed market, look at the yield curve on page 9. You can sort of see the performance of the various fixed at the top there, those yellow charts. So you can see high yield did very well for the quarter, up 2.7%. And then long government credit did 1.6. But you could see the other ones very, you know, very muted returns. And, you know, our expected returns over the next 20 years for bonds are like 4%, you know, so very, very low. And you can see the yield curve right down here at the bottom. You see, you know, some movement in the yield curve there. You could see the dark green line is 331. So it did move up a little bit, but you could see the longer end of the curve about right on top of each other. And that's basically it. They put noteworthy developments in here. So on the last, we sort of always talk about that, pages 17, 18, and 19. And just really, financial assets outpace economic growth in the current expansion. So that sort of shows you there. And that's why a lot of people are talking about U.S. equities just being really maybe overvalued at this, you know, at this point. Page 18 just really talks about, you know, again, equity risk and U.S. equity risk versus maybe some of those other asset classes. And then high yield. We talked about how well high yield had been doing, and that's there on page 19.
You guys have an opinion on, like, you know, business cycles, you tend to have a correction every 7 years. We do not have that correction in stock markets, just been like on steroids lately. You know, I mean, if the tax package doesn't get through, or, you know, healthcare doesn't make it through the Senate, you know, I mean, like, are there things out there that you guys are looking at that may that
affect
market, or?
I mean, because we focus on DB plans, because, you know, and that is most of what, you know, we consult to. Most of our plans are, you know, 20, 30 years out, right? So a long period of time. So we tend to try to have our clients invest for the long term. So we're not having clients, you know, go in and out of markets. We just, you know, we don't recommend that, and it doesn't do well. You might be able to find when to get out of a market. You can't figure out when to get back in.
Right. And so I'm not suggesting we move in and out, but just, you know.
But we do have assets that are favored more than other things, and right, so if we have somebody who's looking at an asset allocation today, and we're saying, okay, you know, these are asset classes you should look at that you don't have, some of them we don't favor versus others. So we're U.S. equity, we actually are seeing more opportunities in emerging markets going forward than we do U.S. equity going forward. We see more in emerging market debt too. We see more value there than we do in you know, U.S. equities, because it has the run-up that it has had. Not that we think people shouldn't have money in U.S. equity, it's just, you know, there's some that are in favor in different times than others. And so I think we'll see that. Now, when it exactly turns, nobody can predict when that turn is going to come. And that's why we try to keep you as diversified as, you know, as we can. So if you look on we're going to go to page 24, your portfolio. And I want to say, I was just thinking about this, I want to say this is probably a high watermark for you at $133 million. You've had a lot of contributions, obviously, but $133 million, $206,851. So that's the largest market value, page 24, sorry, of the book. The largest market value I've seen. So, and I've been with this plan for a decade or so. Nice to see that. Nice to see the assets growing. Your target to large caps 14, you're at 15, so no issues to rebalance there. Your target to small caps 6, and you're at 7, so no issues there. And that's not because you set them higher, it's because they've grown versus other asset classes. International target at 22 and you're at 21. So your total target to equity is 42% and you're at 43.47. And I've reminded you of this before, but because you are a closed plan, your asset allocation is a lot different than other people in the state. So whenever you compare yourself, if you're looking on a sheet about 5-year returns, even 1-year returns of other plans in the state, you're probably not gonna do as well as they do when equities do really well, right? Because you have less equities than Tallahassee, someone else, you know, another plan in the state because you're closed. And it's done that way on purpose to bring your risk level down, okay? So your fixed income target's 32, you're at 29.65, so just in your range there, so that's good. Your target to real estate, 12.5, and you're at 11.43. So good there. And, you know, if you look there, if you remember, so you commit money to these real estate funds, and then they call it as they buy buildings. So if you look at the first one, the long wharf there, you've given them all the money that you're going to give them. You're going to get this $139,000 back shortly. The long wharf five, you still owe them a little bit of money. So about $2 million you still owe them that they'll be buying buildings. The Penn Square, they never took the full amount, which happens sometimes. So you're going to get all this money back. They're not going to ask you for any money. So the 602, you're getting that money back. Colony, they've called all their money. You're starting to see distributions. If you look at that 2.1, you're going to get all that money back over the next 2 or 3 years. It's just going to keep coming back to you. Again, the next town square, you still owe them a little bit of money. So they'll probably call maybe $1 million over the next year. And then Westport, you owe them maybe $500,000. I don't know that they'll call it because they've already started distributing money to you. So, I was taught, the reason I sort of asked about the liquidity and I was doing some numbers here, you have about 5% tied up in these investments, so it's not very much. Everything else in your portfolio is liquid. This allocation of real estate has helped your portfolio, has kept the returns very strong. You've done really well here. I do recommend that we do a search here and get you another manager. You're getting all this money back. And to keep at your 12.5, which you're only at 11.4, you're going to have to put that money back to work again. So you're going to need to interview managers at the next meeting. You don't need to vote on that, but I'll bring you some managers to consider at the next meeting to keep that allocation. Even if over the next 10 years or 15 years, all your people are going to, you know, go away, a 5% allocation here is not going to cause liquidity constraints. So I think you need to keep that up to keep your returns strong. On the alternative side, you've got 13.5 target. You're at 11.8, so just in your range there. And then you've got some more cash here, which Alicia and I have recently talked about, allocating that cash, which I think you did that last week.
Yes, all but one is taking the money. Yeah, there was a 30-day window we had to give them.
Okay.
Yeah, so it'll be done by, I think, June 1st or July 1st. I think we just missed the June 1st. Okay. We were discussing it like the 3rd or 4th.
Okay.
So,
yeah. So this cash has now been, you know, invested, which is, I don't want you really to have more than like 1% of cash unless Alicia needs it to use it right away. We try to keep you fully invested, which gives you the best returns. This new box here on the bottom left, Bernie was very diligent and wanted this in your guidelines to really track not just your actuary coming in, but just really track where you were funded-wise. And as you get more funded, to ratchet down your risk. So instead of, you know, as you get more funded, almost to like indemnify those dollars so you can't be losing them, right? So take down the risk of the portfolio. So we're tracking that here. It's not going to really affect you until I think your guidelines say above 70% or so. The liability on here, and Doug can look at this, show him a report, but the liability here is from Doug. He gave us this, but the market value is from us. So what I did was I took the current market value that you have in this book and use the liabilities from your last valuation. And so that gives you the numbers. And we do that semi-annually. So in this report, and then in the one, which will be your fiscal report in September, we'll put this little box so you can sort of see where you are. And then page 25 is your returns for the quarter. So you had a very strong quarter, up 4.31%, strong one-year number up 10.72%, and across the board, your three-year and five-year numbers are under slightly, outperform on the seven-year, 10-year, and since inception. So good returns. Everybody always asks if those are net or gross. Those are gross returns. Why do I show you gross returns? Because the benchmarks are gross. There's no way for me to show you a net benchmark. So if I showed you net returns and that's a gross benchmark, it's not really apples to apples. But if you ever want to look at net, net is in here. It's page 32. So you can see your total fund on a net basis. And even on a net basis, for the quarter, you did very well, up 4.22. So this is page 32. 1 year, 10.33, so you can see all the net returns, net of your fees. Since inception, you outperformed by 80 basis points, net of fees. And so that's a real additive to your portfolio. So if anybody asks you, you know, you look at gross, but what's the net returns been? This is always in your book, so you do know. But that, why I always review the gross is because benchmarks, there's no way for me to net them. Okay? And some asset classes, we don't have index funds for you to even be in, so it's a really hard comparison. Your fiscal years are on page 26 and 27. We don't go over those, but you can, you know, always look at your fiscal returns if you want, and those are what Doug uses for his reports, page 26 and 27. And then we'll just go to page 29 and go through your managers, like we always do. Last year was the worst year in, 35 years for active management. So 2016, index fund beat most of active managers. Like 80% of active managers were beat by the index in 2016. So it was the toughest year for active management that we've seen. And you saw my questions to him. A lot of people are moving to indexing because of that. And active managers will tell you this is the worst time to move to indexing, right? Because we just come off a 5 or 6 year where indexing was favored. Active management should be favored for the next 5 years. This would be the perfect wrong time to go do that. Some would say that's self-serving on their part, obviously, because that's what they do, right? And that's how they get paid. So you can take all of that with a grain of salt, and you can ask me hard questions once we'll go through this. But Wedge Capital doing well for the quarter. If you look at their long year number, even net of fees, they've outperformed since inception. They've done very well. They've had a tougher 1 year period, but you can see 3 year, 5 year in line, 7 year outperforming, 10 year, and since inception outperforming. And net of fees, they've outperformed. So very good manager, no recommendations there. Both Wellington and Siegel Bryant Hamill you hired at the same time. I think you brought Wellington in maybe the meeting before last to talk to you. So these managers are two that we've been concerned about. Wellington outperformed slightly for the quarter, but you could see lagging on the 1 year, the 3 year, and the 5 year, and since inception. And that's the same with Siegel Bryant Hamill. They outperformed for the quarter, but you could see lagging 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, and since inception. So we're going to just hold that for a minute. We'll go back there and then talk about your other managers. So Templeton doing well, outperforming for the 1 year, in line there. Yes, a little bit tough on the 3 and 5 year, but since inception, they've had strong performance, 10 years of strong performance. I don't see any issues there. Acadian doing very well, outperforming over all periods. Pyramus doing very, very well. Outperforming overall periods. Double Line doing very well. UBS, again, we've talked about them. They're one of the largest real estate managers in the country. They're always going to be a little bit behind, outperforming since inception, but a little bit, poor real estate's a hard place to be. And so even though that benchmark's 12, I think a 10% return on the 3 and 5 year, 7 year returns are fine. Wellington, you hired to replace PIMCO. If you remember, they were doing a similar thing. They really kicked it out of the ballpark since you hired them, doing very well. Atos is another one. So the three managers I really think we need to talk about is Wellington on the large cap growth, Siegel Bryan Hamill, and Atos. Atos had a really good quarter. We're seeing hedge funds sort of maybe come out of this that they have been in over the last 5 years. Your manager is a top quartile manager for hedge funds, but still not really done over since inception what you wanted them to do, right? You wanted them to be 524 net of fees. They're about 4%. They're about 3.5%, 3% net of fees, not really where you wanted them to be. And then your cash portfolio. So, and then we move to page 31, which goes through all your real estate managers. Doing well, have consistently done well. If you remember, you always look at that since inception IRR for them, as opposed to any just sort of quarter or 3 year, that's sort of noise. All very strong returns. Long Wharf is just at the beginning of the fund, and when you're in the beginning of the fund, I talked to you about the J curve, you know, as they're taking fees, it takes a little while for them to come out of that. But no issues there with any of those managers. So if we go back and talk about Wellington and Siegel Bryan Hamill and Atos, you know, and I think you talked to me at some point about, you know, indexing there and thinking about indexing and that kind of thing, and maybe talk about their presentation and sort of what you thought about it. I'm not inclined to recommend any action at this point, but I think that these three managers are ones that we have to watch, and maybe throughout this year we may get to a point where we need to maybe make a change. And so, I don't know your sort of thoughts around their presentation from the day, if anybody had any feedback on that.
I just think keep an eye on them, and you know, some of it can be indexed. Large cap is easily done. I'm not opposed to it.
So they're on the watch list?
Yes. Yeah, and they've been on the watch list. And I think the fact that they gave us a fee reduction is good. We're going to go through your list. We do this periodically and just see if we could get fee reductions from anybody else. I think that's important in the active management place that we are. So we'll go through, especially on your equity managers, and see if we can get other fee reductions for other managers, because fees have been compressed. We did get a big fee reduction from Atos. You know, they reduced their fee once, they reduced it again another time, so we've gotten some fee reductions there. The thing with Atos is, I think that we've had hedge funds for 7 years. They haven't really done what you wanted them to do. I think Wellington is sort of doing what you wanted, has the characteristics, and a lot cheaper fee doing it. So I think over time, maybe over the next year, maybe we could see some recovery in hedge funds, maybe get a little bit of a bump there, and then maybe move that money into like a Wellington or another product over time. I just don't know that, given the fees that hedge funds give you, that they're really giving you what you were looking for when you hired them originally. And if that's the case, then maybe if we see some recovery this year, which having up almost 3% for the quarter, you know, you multiply that by four, if they could give us a 10 this year, they could give us an 8 or 10, I mean, we would be in a position. But I think that once you get to that position, you're probably still going to want to move away from them, because it's just not what you hired them to do. It's way more volatile than you thought it was going to be. But I don't think that this is the time to, and I think Cindy sort of asks, like, well, what do you see? And sometimes from a tactical point of view, it's almost more you look at when the right place is to exit something that you don't want to have really long term. And so I think that probably you're not at the right place to exit this, but I think you might be over the next, say, 6 months to a year to find a place to maybe move out of that. And Arnie's never liked how much the fees are in hedge funds either. You know, and if you're not getting paid for it, for the fees, you know, move away from it. And then Wellington, I think we just have to watch. See, you know, the thing is you would say, oh, you know, Rose, this manager's just not great. But if you look at really when you hired both of them in 2011, it's really a time where all active management struggled. So it's hard to say, you know, these are all great managers. I actually think that Siegel, Bryant, Hamill, and Wellington are still strong managers. I think people are actually going in and hiring them right now. So I don't know that it would be the point where I want you to, you know, move away from them. So that's my sort of thought there. And that's it. Any questions? We can go through questions, but they are going to be on, you know, our really closely watched list, and we'll talk about them again at the next meeting. And I'm going to bring real estate managers for you to review at the next meeting.
The existing managers that we have now, will you be bringing them in terms of additional offerings that they're doing?
I will reach out to all of them and see if they have anything in the market. And we actually did that a couple months ago. And you just gave Longworth more money for this new fund that they have. So they probably don't, I know they didn't have a fund when we talked to them. But Town Square might have a fund, which would be a good, you know, a good add-on to what you have.
Thank you, Rosemary. I now turn it to the attorney.
Well, the legislative session was supposed to adjourn last Friday.
But just kidding.
They didn't have a budget. Yeah, just kidding. They're reconvening this week to try to adopt the budget.
Theoretically, they're going to vote today.
I think that's probably all they're going to take up. And we said at our last quarterly meeting, I didn't anticipate that we would be hurt this session, and we're not. We came out of this session unscathed, basically, which is a good thing.
It's not true for the rest of the city, but for the pension plan.
Yeah. They've done enough to us with the mortality table mandate.
Yeah.
So that's the update there. Also, you have in your materials the restated plan document that I did, incorporating current internal revenue provisions and through and including the ordinance, consolidating everything, and also some of your plan description on that. I don't know if you want to take any action on either of those today or not. Now, ultimately, the restated ordinance would have to be adopted by the council.
Since we're short on board today, we may defer that until a full board is presented. Thank you. Has everyone had the opportunity? Well, everyone would be Anthony and I at the moment. And I think it probably would not be proper for me to second, but here's John. All right. John, we're moving into the minutes. Have you had an opportunity to review them?
Mm-hmm.
Anthony, can I have a motion?
Make a motion to accept.
Second.
Terrific. And a vote, all in favor? Right. Our next item would be more in the matter of an announcement. You're probably made aware of the fact that the Sunshine Law Seminar put on by the city attorney, which has been rescheduled to Thursday, May the 25th. If you have not been to one of these, I would strongly suggest it. And they're asking that by May the 5th, which is past, that you indicate whether you'll be attending. So if you've not made up your mind on this yet, I'm sure they'd still be happy to honor your request to participate. Performance evaluations. Shall we wait again, perhaps,
yeah,
until we have a full board?
Well, we sent out a survey to about 15 different cities for some information that Arnie had wanted, and at first we weren't getting any responses, so then we took and we sent them in as public reference requests, and now we're starting to get those filtered in. So once we have all that information, we'll compile it for everyone and get it out.
Terrific. Is there anything that I have missed?
There is a budget that we passed out. It's for informational item for this board. The police and fire have to take action, but since we do it for them, we thought we'd pass it along to you. This is the budget that was submitted for this board to the city. As you can see, it's in line with last year's, a little bit less. We aren't expecting as many drop payouts. So Rose, I should not be requesting any money for any large payouts this year. Unless someone leaves early, that's sometimes the case. But in looking at this and with the contributions, we should definitely not have to pull down any cash this year. Last year, I think we had once or twice. Prior year, seemed like it was every other month we were asking for money. So that has, you know, slacked off. Hopefully what we get to invest stays there this year. We only have one scheduled payout, and it's $52,000, so we should be able to cover that. And it's at the end of the year, so.
Terrific. Thank you, Lisa.
You're welcome.
And if you ever want to look at that, that's in our book. So under tab 2 at the back of our book, the last tab, which is page 39, it just gives you a cash flow. So if you're ever looking to see what your market values were, you know, so when we started with the plan, you were $48 million. We've grown to $133 million. Just the gain in the 3 months was a $5 million investment gain for a three-month period. That's why I said very strongly.
Any
credit for that. But you could just sort of see, and then you could sort of see how 2008 affected you and how long it took you to come back from that there. And just if you're looking at that, you know, it can help if you... Some people, you know, returns resonate with them, percentage returns, but some people are like, I want to see dollars, like I want to know what dollars made, you know, so that always shows you the dollars.
Since I've been appointed, selected, punished, whatever it is, to be vice chair, I think I would like to go to this annual conference that they're going to have in Orlando.
Okay.
To familiarize myself with some of the
vendors. FPTA?
Yes.
That may be full by now.
You reckon?
Yeah.
Well,
I'll check. Do you want to stay at a nearby hotel?
Well, if it's full, let me know.
Okay. Yeah, because they only allow
250.
So I will let you know.
Right. If there is no further business to come before us, I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
I'll second that.
All right, we have a motion.
Second.
We have a second. We are adjourned. And thank you, Beth.